Shared interests in looking at the representations of North and South. And so we've got this project together, and we're looking at 1837 to 1947. We're going to look at newspaper representations, we're going to look at literature, art and culture. And these talks are kind of leading up to this project. So it's really exciting to get new research being presented, debates with people. And the other two talks have been really interesting. Really looking forward to hearing about LARCing and to what extent does LARCing connect with harm? This particular place or any place. Interested to hear what your response is. I'm delighted that Dr. Daniel Weston, who's going to speak first, is going to talk about his work on LARCing, his insights. He's written a lot about literature and plays, he's published about LARCing. Who's interested in why they all have that topic. And then followed by James Underwood, who's here about who will talk secondly. And he's he won very prestigious and competitive university PhD scholarship to work on Philip Larkin. He's worked on it at the archive of the BBC. He's got some new ways of thinking about Larkin to work here from the second. And they've very kindly brought some books, so in the break, anybody wants to look at books here and do come forward and do that. So just over to James now. Sorry.
Thanks so much, Catherine. Can everyone hear me at the back? The level's okay? Excellent. Good. So thanks for coming along. We're going to be talking to this title, asking what Philip Larkin and other poets have to say to Hull as a city and about Hull as a city, and how different audiences might perceive that poetry differently. So I think it's probably fair to assume that when we take on the City of Culture in 2017, there'll be a role for poetry in that, and poetry of and about Hull will play a big part in that. So perhaps what we want to do today is to look at a range of issues which are important for thinking about the relationship between poetry and place, and to ask some questions about that particular relationship between Hull and poetry. Is Hull a poetic place? And what exactly might such a phrase mean? What kind of relationships does it bespeak between a poet, a place, and a reader as well? And who gets to say? I think it's important to notice that we're in a particular setting here. We're in the university in this town, but also many of you will be from Hull too. So that's certainly something we need to consider here. So who gets to say what poetry about Hull might be about, might say? Before we look at Hull in particular, and we're going to look at a range of poets, I think it's fair to say that we're only going to scratch the surface, as there is so much material we could talk about here, and that's indicative, it's important in itself. Before we talk about whole poets, I want to address this issue of the poetry of place in a broader sense. So in a recent issue of Poetry Review, the editor of that publication, Fiona Sampson, wrote an editorial which focused on place and poetry about place in terms of belonging and rootedness. And this seems to me to be one of the dominant ways that we talk about the poetry of place, as an expression of being rooted in a place, of belonging to it. This is an idea that gets handed down to us from a long romantic legacy. Wordsworth and his poetry of Grasmere in the Lake District bespeak this idea of being embedded in a place, and that's handed down, and it seems that Fiona Sampson's editorial corroborates the idea that that's the dominant way we think about place in poetry today. Of modern poets, I think Seamus Heaney is perhaps the most famous sort of exponent of this idea, this way of thinking. From the start of his career with poems like Digging, in his first collection, Death of a Naturalist, through the 1970s in some of those famous place name poems that he writes in a collection called Wintering Out. He has been the most important figure in this way of conceiving of place and poetry and their relationship. There are alternatives, though. We needn't only think about place and poetry as being an expression of rootedness, of belonging, of being embedded in a place. There are other different ways of thinking about this. And I want to start with a younger poet, Joe Shapcott, who is someone who studied under Heaney at the start of her career writing poetry and reacted against his way of conceiving of place. So in this essay, Confounding Geography, she writes about a disjuncture between Heaney's description of being embedded in the deep, rich soil of his native Northern Ireland and the experience she has in her life at that point. She grew up in Hemel Hempstead, which she suggests is a less interesting place, or a less kind of poetic place, a more prosaic place, one that's a sort of bland commuter town. That's her assertion rather than mine. I've never been to Hemel Hempstead. And she says that Heaney's way of relating to place is not typical of experience today. And she says, since the start of her career writing poetry, her quest, and I quote, has been to discover how to be a different kind of writer for whom place and language are less certain and for whose shifting territories are the norm. Shifting transience is an idea that she's interested in. She writes a lot about Elizabeth Bishop, who's another poet, who she draws from and adopts the thinking of in relation to the poetry of place. Now, Elizabeth Bishop has a much less certain relationship with the places she wrote about than Seamus Heaney does. She's a poet who grew up out of her native country. She's American, but grew up in Canada and then spent a long time living in Brazil. And it's something of an outsider, an incomer, someone who's not from the place that she writes about. And Joe Shapcott thinks this is perhaps a more typical way of experiencing place. And she says of Elizabeth Bishop, this is the second paragraph there on the PowerPoint slides. A life spent traveling for long periods in other countries, a distaste and longing for political and emotional reasons for one's homeland. These aspects of Bishop's life felt familiar to me, and as I came to understand, more typical of Western contemporary experience than rootedness. Now, this seems to me to be quite a powerful argument to suggest that actually most people's experience of place today is not of belonging to one place exclusively, but experiencing this sense of transience, moving about, spending some time in different places. And I think as a prelude to thinking about the poetry of Hull, this is an interesting way of looking at it. Many of the poets who we're going to consider are incomers or spend some time in Hull and then move away again. And they write about the place whilst they're here. And they exploit this position of being an incomer, being in some senses an outsider, and use the perspectives that frees up. So it opens up a set of questions. How do Hull poets experience the city? Do you need to be of a place to write about a place? And how do local audiences perceive this set of circumstances? So let's start with Larkin. We're going to talk about a lot of poets. Well, not a lot, a few poets, but we'll start with Larkin. He's not from Hull, but he settles here and beds down, but he doesn't necessarily feel a strong sense of belonging, or even perhaps a weak sense of belonging. He sort of relishes this position of not being quite settled. His statements about the relationship between his poetry and the place of Hull are few and far between, and those that he does make don't make for any kind of easy alignment of him as a Hull poet, in inverted commas. He wrote a foreword to an anthology of Hull poetry, which we'll look at in more detail in a little while, called A Rumoured City. And in his foreword to that collection, he says, "Poetry, like prose, happens anywhere." And this is a phrase that is sort of connected perhaps to those lines that conclude his poem, "I Remember, I Remember," where, when he's recalling his uneventful childhood, he reflects that nothing like something happens anywhere. So in his foreword, he goes on to explain and perhaps to a certain extent mitigate this seeming lack of enthusiasm for the task he set himself. And he says that Hull got its clearance on this from Andrew Marvell many years ago, Andrew Marvell being a 17th century writer from Hull, or who wrote about Hull. And he says, "Hull is as good a place to write in as any. It's better, in fact, than some," he says. And I think it's worth reading out, though it's a couple of paragraphs, the bulk of what he says in his foreword to A Rumoured City. So we'll just read this out. "Hull is still a good place to write in as any. Better, in fact, than some. For a place cannot produce poems, it can only not prevent them. And Hull is good at that. It neither impresses nor insists. When your train comes to rest in Paragon Station against a row of docile buffers, you alight with an end-of-the-line sense of freedom. Signs in foreign languages welcome you. Outside is a working city, yet one neither clenched in the blackened grip of the Industrial Revolution, nor hiding behind a cathedral to pretend it is York or Canterbury. Unpretentious, recent, full of shops and special offers, like a television commercial, it might be Australia or America until you come upon Trinity House or the dock offices. For Hull has its own sudden elegancies. In Hull, people sense that they have found a city that is in the world, yet sufficiently on the edge of it to have a different resonance. Behind Hull is the plain of Holderness, lonelier and lonelier, and after that the birds and lights of Spurn Head and then the sea. One can go 10 years without seeing these things. Yet they are always there, giving Hull the air of having its face half turned toward distance and silence and what lies beyond them." I'm not sure how, like, Australia or America Hull really is, but we'll give him some license for that. So this is initially a description of what Hull isn't. It's not dark satanic mills. It's not a medieval museum piece. But then this gives way to a more positive description of what Hull is. And it's got, for Larkin, two qualities. And the first is its expression of prosaic contemporary existence, its worldliness, in a way. And secondly, that very close to Hull, in very close proximity to it, is this place of contemplation and withdrawal, the Holderness Plain. And the second atmosphere, the atmosphere of the Holderness Plain, for Larkin, occupies the city alongside the first. He says you don't have to visit the Holderness Plain very often to feel its presence in the city somehow. I noted earlier that part of what Larkin says in his foreword to Rumoured City bears resemblance to what he says in the poem I Remember, I Remember. And we can also see connections here between what he says in this foreword and the poem here. Now, here isn't one of Larkin's train poems, but it is a poem certainly of transit and of arrival. Swerving east, it starts from rich industrial shadows. It moves towards and then beyond the city. Now, all the materials that we're talking about are on the handouts printed on pink paper that are on the table, so you can have a look at these in your own time following up on the session, though I'm sure many of you are already familiar with these materials. So from the scrubby pastoral of the first stanza, we move towards Hull, which comes as what Larkin calls the surprise of a large town. And the specificity of the description of Hull in this poem is larger, I think, than we see in most other poems that are sort of set in Hull. We get domes and statues, spires and cranes, you might say, in any city, but then the definition of Hull's particularity is added in the barge-crowded water, the next line. And then further in the next stanza, in the pastoral of ships up streets and the slave museum. It's perhaps the description of the people of Hull that's more interesting here, though. Now, teaching this poem in Larkin classes, I thought that my students, particularly those students who are from Hull, might object to the description of local people from Hull in these poems, but they didn't, and I was surprised by that initially, but I'm going to describe how I came around perhaps to their sense of these poems. Is there a denigration of these people in calling them residents from raw estates and describing their material desires, the cheap clothing and kitchen appliances of department stores in town? Perhaps there is something of that, but I think there's also a much more positive way of reading these lines. So their description, the people of Hull being described as a cut-price crowd, urban yet simple, I think is actually an endorsement. Simple is not a synonym for stupid here. Rather, it's a celebration of their lack of pretension. And it chimes with what we hear Larkin saying in the foreword to Rumoured City, where he suggests that Hull is unpretentious, recent. These are the things that he's perhaps celebrating here. Its central two stanzas are about Hull, but then the poem moves on further east to the unfenced existence, as Larkin calls it, of the landscape beyond the city. This place, in contrast to those middle two stanzas, is unpeopled largely. We don't get to see people there, though it does have a luminously peopled air, it says in that final stanza. It's a quite opaque phrase, but one I think that describes an interchange between the peopled city and the unpeopled plain beyond it. As Larkin says in his foreword, the atmospheres of the two places interpenetrate one another and come together in this place. It's almost as if the Holderness Plain is a zone of reflection, a place where you might go in retreat from the city. And this is certainly a feature that we see in other poems. So moving on from here, we can look at a couple of other poems. So Envoy by Douglas Dunn envisions a kind of pastoral retreat to the Holderness Plain. So this is a poem that Douglas Dunn writes about his wife's experience of the city and her experience of going out to the Holderness Plain from it. Why did I bring you to this hole, this rancid and unbeautiful surprise of damp and Englishness? Now I choose to remember bus rides together into Holderness, exploring the hedgerow heat on country walks by fields of mustard. And we can see the same thing happen in Douglas Houston's poem, Driver, where he writes, driving through the city's sodium yellow A-roads, my own compass set for the marshy coastal flats. Out there, I'll be quite at ease and shivering if this refrigerated summer has its way. Now, I think this final line perhaps complicates the pastoral there, but there's certainly a sense in which the Holderness Plain is a sort of zone of transcendence, in a way. So before we move on from Larkin to talk in detail about other poets, let's just try and position him on this barometer of place. So if Heaney's at one extreme and his idea is that we ought to belong in place to feel rooted and poetry is the expression of that, and we have Joe Shapcott at the other extreme suggesting that poetry ought to all be about transience and is often most productive when it's written from the perspective of an outsider, we perhaps have Larkin feeling unrooted in Hull, but pleasantly so. He sees that as a benefit. He does recognise Hull's particularity, but he also recognises that the position of an outsider, someone coming in, opens up perspectives on the commonplace in a useful way. So I want to move on to talk about Douglas Dunn a bit more. So Douglas Dunn is a poet who is also plays a big role in bringing people together, poets together in Hull, and galvanizes a lot of poets, younger poets, in the early 80s. And A Rumoured City, which Larkin writes the foreword for, is actually edited by Douglas Dunn. And Douglas Dunn's own editorial introduction is, in lots of ways, quite similar to Larkin's foreword, I guess unsurprisingly in some ways. So let's have a look at what he says about the city and notice some of the similarities and differences here. So he says, like most cities built on the banks of an estuary, Hull has a marginal, provisional, almost frontier quality. It is a city of generous character, and it is difficult to live in it for any length of time and remain oblivious of its available but undefinable identity. Hull may be flat and lacking in landmarks or elegant streets. It is no Edinburgh or Bath. It has never been fashionable or immodestly rich. But there is something in Hull which encourages an imaginative response to corners and detail, sights and sounds, the effects of light and seasons. Not only does Hull appeal to the imagination, but the longer you live here, the more you become aware that it is a town which by its nature recommends the plainly human, the seriousness of what, in more glamorous places, is taken to be ordinary. It leads a writer to meditate on the rag and bone shop of the heart. Looked at from elsewhere, it may seem a backwater on the map of Britain. Lived in, though, and it is seen to have its own backwaters, to have its own map of lives and places, to be its own world. So the first paragraph, I think you'll agree, is strikingly similar to Larkin. Initially, the city is described in terms of what it's not. Here, it's Bath or Edinburgh, where Larkin has York or Canterbury. And the chief quality that's identified is a sense of the marginal, of the provisional, that is conferred by this city. There's also the abundance of the plainly human, the ordinary life here. What Larkin values as unpretentious and recent, I think, is broadly speaking the same thing as what Dunn is identifying here. There's also something else, though, which I think is perhaps implicit in what Larkin says, but gets more explicit airing here, and that's the distinction between perspectives on Hull looked at from elsewhere and lived in. So come to from elsewhere as a visitor and lived in for a duration of time. And for Dunn, the latter perspective, living in Hull, allows for us to see things which we might miss first time round. I think there's a claim to authority being made here, authority and authenticity, saying I have lived in this place, therefore I am a resident and allowed to speak about it. But that's also measured against Dunn's acknowledgement that he is an incomer. The same might be said of Larkin, who, if you remember, if we look back to his introduction to Rumoured City, dramatises this coming to see Hull as the arrival of a train. You arrive on Paragon Station against the row of docile buffers. You alight with an end-of-the-line sense of freedom. So in the second person there, he talks about us arriving in Hull as a visitor, and that's something which is crucial to Douglas Dunn as well. And I think this issue comes to be perhaps the defining feature of Dunn's collection of poems about Terry Street, published in 1969. And these poems are inspired by a couple of years he spent living on Flixburgh Terrace, Terry Street, just off the Beverley Road. Then a working class neighbourhood of housing, some would say slum housing, some indeed did say slum housing, which has more recently been torn down and bulldozed in the 1970s. So looking back at the writing of these poems 25 years after their initial publication, Dunn draws attention to the difference he felt and that he felt others felt of him as a Scot living here and as somebody connected with the university. As a university student, he seemed sort of out of place in this neighbourhood, he writes. So he says, I found it hard to get to know any of my neighbours. To them it seemed important and negative that I wasn't local and was at the college. Were they worried in case we were setting a trend, students buying small houses in their midst? It could have looked like a comment on what they were worth. Some of them seemed to spend a lot of time looking at me. I spent a lot of time looking back. Maybe that's what the poems are about. Summing up, he says, I didn't belong there and others did and I knew it. So I think the tone of the poems that emerges here is broadly sort of documentary, if you will. And this is accentuated by their metrics. They're broadly iambic, they're unrhymed largely, they're quite prosy in their use of enjambment. This adds to the feel of a documentary being given here. Douglas Dunn says, they're almost shameful in their candour and speed of writing. One good consequence of becoming an incomer, he continues, is that it was impossible to write about the past or sidetrack oneself with the place's nostalgia. Hence, for him, the purview is mostly one of observation here. That said, he does dramatise this relationship between the poet as observer and the people of Terry Street as observed, and he does so in very interesting and subtle ways. And I want to look at one poem to study this. Perhaps the text's a little small on the PowerPoint, but again, the poem is on your handout. So I'll just read this poem through and then have a little think about it afterwards. This is The Clothes Pit. The young women are obsessed with beauty. Their old-fashioned sewing machines rattle in Terry Street. They must keep up, they must keep up. They wear teasing skirts and latest shoes, lush, impermanent coats, American cosmetics, but they lack intellectual grooming. In the culture of clothes and little philosophies, they only have clothes. They did not need to be seen carrying a copy of International Times or the Liverpool poets, the wish to justify their looks with things beyond themselves. They mix up colours, and somehow they are often fat and unlovely. They don't get high on pot, but get sick on cheap Spanish burgundy or beer in rampant pubs, and come home supported and kissed and bad-tempered. But they have clothes, bright enough to show they dream of places other than this, in inarticulate paradise, eating exotic fowl in sunshine with courteous boys. Three girls go down the street with the summer wind. The litter of pop rhetoric blows down Terry Street, bounces past their feet into their lives. This poem's typical of the 18 that Dunn wrote about Terry Street in describing them in the third person. Only one poem uses we, including the narrator, and two others attempt to establish a connection between the observed and the observer. But one of these attempts is dramatised as a failure even then. So the first two stanzas of The Clothes Pit, this poem, I think with their end stop lines, read like an indictment. They escalate to a lack of intellectual grooming. But with a shift to more complex run-on sentences, sentences that run past the end of the line, in the rest of the poem, we also see some complexity added to these ideas. And as that complexity is introduced, there's more sort of self-doubt introduced into the observer's position. Perhaps the self-regard of the countercultural intellectual, whether this be the narrator or Dunn or both or neither, wishing to justify their looks, leads to an increased self-scrutiny here. The girl's lack of self-consciousness is perhaps a quality that the observer can't replicate, that the poet can't replicate. So in that way, perhaps we can say this observation bears some kinship to Larkin's appreciation of the no-nonsense stoicism of what he calls the cut-price crowd in the poem here. In The Clothes Pit, the first comparison between the narrator and the girls on Terry Street is a contrast. The culture of clothes and the little philosophies in the first line of the third stanza there. There's a disparity between them. But then in later phases of the poem, does come around to express likenesses. So the bright colours of the girls' clothes, the narrator supposes, expresses their dreams of other places, just as the intellectual's books bespeak an interest in things beyond. Things beyond is a phrase the poem actually uses. This poem is perhaps typical of the Terry Street poems in moving from these observations towards a more profound reflection at its close. It's not clear what the final stanza's vignette does to the establishment of fellow feeling that the poem has worked towards. It's left unclear. As a proviso to understanding, or sorry, my reading of the poem, I think it's probably worth saying that this establishment of fellow feeling doesn't lead to dialogue here. There's no sense in which the audience of this poem are the same as the people described in the poem. We're told in the poem that the residents of Terry Street aren't interested in the books of the observer, the narrator. Even more, they probably, you know, it's safe to say they would not, from this observer's position, be interested in poetry. So they remain the object of study for a sort of sociological or documentary kind of poetry, much more than participants in that exchange. Now, I'm aware that standing here as a representative of, I guess, the college or the university, and as somebody who is also an incomer, there's something that I need to address there as well, and that these same observations I'm making about Douglas Dunn, you might also make about me. So this poem, and I think what we said about Larkin also, prompts us to ask some questions about what it means to write a poem about a place. What do these poems mean to you as much as what do they mean to me? If this is a more favourable treatment of the people of Hull than we see in Larkin's poetry, what does that mean? Does that act as some kind of mitigation for studying the people of Terry Street, or does it remain problematic? What sort of questions does it prompt us to ask? So I've looked at a couple of poems there, poets there, should I say, Larkin and Dunn. I'm going to hand over to James now, who's going to consider a few more before we bring the talk part of today's event to a close, and we can move towards a more sort of discussion-based approach.